This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Eschelbach, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Eschelbach.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And now, the pro-life news.
A new report by the Indiana State Department of Health shows that the abortion rate continues to decline in Indiana. In 2015, there were just under 8,000 abortions, compared to just over 8,000 in 2014. Abortions have declined in Indiana for 7 consecutive years. The state's all-time high was 16,505 in 1980. The report also shows that chemical abortions continue to increase, accounting for 27.9% of terminations in 2015. According to Sue Swayze, Indiana Right to Life Vice President for Public Affairs, quote, Indiana is a decidedly pro-life state because we have leaders willing to fight for alternatives to abortion, end quote. Swayze indicated that she and her allies will continue efforts to extend the trend of declining abortions across the state, saying, quote, we mourn for both the lives lost and the women whose lives will never be the same. Abortion hurts both women and children, end quote. The same state report indicates that 326 Allen County residents ended their pregnancies at Indiana abortion facilities in 2015. The county hasn't had an abortion facility since December 2013, but according to Kathy Humbarger, executive director of Allen County Right to Life, quote, Fort Wayne's Planned Parenthood continues to refer for the life-ending procedure. Allen County women need to know that there is help and hope. We have pregnancy resource centers located throughout Allen County. These centers are available to see a woman through her specific circumstances, no matter how desperate the situation may seem. In 2015, actual procedures were reported in Hamilton, Lake, Marion, Monroe, St. Joseph, and Tippecanoe counties. Marion County alone reported over 5,000 abortions, which accounts for more than 63% of the life-ending procedures for the year. The second highest number was in Lake County with just under 1,300 procedures, or a little over 16%. You can read more at IRTL.org, where you can also find a link to the Indiana State Department of Health report.
This is your AFA Indiana News Minute. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Conscience Protection Act, which prohibits government from discriminating against healthcare providers who do not want to perform or cooperate in abortions. The bill also gives such healthcare providers the power to bring civil action if they're targeted by such discrimination. House Speaker Paul Ryan said there have been cases of nurses being suspended or threatened with firing solely for the offense of following their conscience, adding, and now the state of California requires all health insurance plans to cover abortion. So if you're a church or a religious school, it doesn't matter. You must cover this procedure. And if it violates your conscience, too bad. Ryan said no one should be forced to violate their conscience, least of all by the federal government. There's more online at afain.net. The American Family Association of Indiana, a voice for Hoosier families.
I did not want to see him there. This was what dying of cancer is like. And my father, being the man he was, took it like a man. It was the hand he'd been dealt, and he was going to play it as bad as it was. This quote is from an article by David Mills, and we are pleased to have him as our guest today on the show. As the Death with Dignity and Right to Die movements begin to add pressure to our legislators, we need to be sure that we are defending the value of life at all stages, and doing so from a compassionate but also truthful stance. And to help us do that today is our guest, David Mills. The article from which that first quote came is called Real Death, Real Dignity. Dying with dignity is not the, quote, death with dignity many propose. And David wrote that article in March of 2011. I would recommend, if you have a chance, to read it. It's a lovely piece, and it's very poetic in nature, but also has wonderful insight into this death with dignity movement that's starting to sweep across our nation. So you can find a link to this article that we'll be talking about today on our website, www.ichooselife.org, and it'll be under the radio tab for you there. David, just to give you a little background, was the executive editor of First Things. He is also the editor of Touchstone magazine before that, and now is the editorial director of Ethica Politica, and also a senior editor for The Stream, which you can find at thestream.org. So has a lot of background in magazine and writing and editing, and we are so glad to have you on today, David. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So, David, I was introduced to you through this piece that you wrote in 2011 for First Things called Real Death, Real Dignity. And in it, you talk about your dad's final fight with cancer. And it's a really touching description that you give of him. Can you tell us a little about him?
Oh, thank you. Yes. I love talking about my dad. you know, he was an engineer, and as I say in the article, he's a kind of theological and religious, he was a religious man, a believer, but I mean, theology was just, I think the questions that interested me just amused him. They just weren't interested. Mm-hmm. He wasn't interested. He's a very practical man. He was a very taciturn man. He made his words count. He was also a very modest and private man. And you know, part of the moving thing in they talk about in the story that has impressed me, it still impresses me, is the fact that, you know, he's dying in a hospice. The nurses and the nurses' aides were young women the ages of his granddaughter. They were bright and cheerful. And you have no sort of privacy or modesty left when you're dying in a hospice as your body starts shutting down. And he dealt with it. And he was a man, he lost his ability to talk. And he was a man who had always made his words count, and suddenly he couldn't talk at all. And essentially death, it's still hard after, you know, 10 years to talk about these things, but without sort of, you know, tearing up.
Yeah.
But he was a man who, you know, everything about his death funded everything that mattered to him. And yet the thing that has impressed me, and, you know, I still ponder, is the fact that even though death did that to him, that this really did sort of take away everything he cared about, everything about who he was, he dealt with it. There were possibilities for euthanasia even then. And that was something he never would have considered because, you know, this is the hand he'd been dealt, as I say in the article. This is, you know, dying is what God had given him to do, and he was going to do it as well as he can. And so he died with what, you know, the death of dignity, people say, was undignified, and he was being cared for by nurses. You know, the whole thing is nurses, his granddaughter's age, everything. The world says that's undignified, and yet by sort of playing the hand he'd been dealt, by dying when, you know, God had him, you know, gave him his time, he showed extraordinary dignity, an eternal or transcendent dignity. And that still marks my life, actually. I still ponder that from time to time. They say in the article, too, I mean, even now, this is 10 years later, I'll be in a bookstore, and occasionally I'll say, hey, that's a book Dad will like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll literally be teaching to the book, and I'll suddenly say, oh, no, wait. And I find myself tearing up in the middle of sort of the aisle of half-price books, and people give you very strange looks and shuffle by.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's part of my life, and part of the reason he's part of my life is he taught me something profound about the human calling and, you know, what God expects us to do. And in his case, it was this dying with dignity and the way, the last condition he would ever have wanted to be in. But he did it. You know, they go on to say in the article, one thing is that he did, I mean, he would have thought this hopelessly pretentious and silly if someone had said it to him. You know, by dying with dignity, he protected the vulnerable from other people taking away their dignity and forcing them to die with what the world calls dignity, essentially euthanizing people. If a man who could choose to die refuses to die on his own, refuses to give death that deal, then he protects people who can't choose. And because the world will say, okay, he's retarded or elderly or senile. I mean, the world will say all sorts of things. Let's choose for him. He'd really rather die, so let's kill him. So the man who says, you know, I can choose that, and I don't choose that because I'm not God. It's not my part to play God. I'm not, you know, I will do what God, you know, essentially what God calls me to do, which is to die when God calls me. He winds up protecting people who don't have that choice, you know, for whom other people will make the choice. And the world is, I mean, you know, people in hospices, they're expensive. They're difficult. They're,
right.
You know, there's a natural sort of logic to it that you would, you know, if you're in charge of a business, which a hospice is, you know, you can rationalize euthanizing this person because he really, if he had the choice, he'd really rather choose this when you're actually looking at your bottom line or just your own convenience.
In your article, you point out that there's a difference between death with dignity, as the movement likes to call itself, and dying with dignity. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, it's more or less what I said earlier is death. The idea of death with dignity is it's clean, it's neat. You go when you want to. you know, you don't wind up in a hospice bed being treated by, as I said, nurse's aides the age of your daughter. You don't die in those sort of embarrassing or even humiliating circumstances. And it's all clean and neat and bright and clear. As I say in the article, what you're actually doing is looking death in the eye and giving him what he wants even sooner than he asks for it. And watching my dad die that way, I can certainly understand the appeal of saying, you know, I'm out of here. I'm out of here on my own terms. You know, the world, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to go and, you know, when I'm at the top of my game, so to speak, or at least, you know, not at the bottom of your game, I can certainly understand the appeal of that. But it just means declaring yourself God.
The Right to Die movement, like you've said, isn't without appeal. I mean, obviously it does have that clean and shiny appeal to it, like you said before, being able to control to a certain extent how much suffering you go through and pain, how much pain you can avoid, and that right humility and embarrassment when your body starts shutting down and you can't control that. But in your dealing with the movement, are there any other benefits that they cite like that? Things that maybe we wouldn't think of, but that are real concerns for people who are considering this early death as a real option?
Oh, and that's a very good question. Yeah, I mean, part of it, I mean, a lot of it, I think Christians have to understand is we have an inside insight. We know something the world doesn't. And, you know, death, when you believe in God and you believe in redemption, as a Christian, it's an entirely different thing than it is for the non-Christian. So suffering, I mean, the Christian knows that suffering is a way of growing in grace, growing in holiness. The crudest sort of worldly terms, it's becoming a better person, a deeper person, a more compassionate person, all those things. So we know that because our faith is in Christ. But from the worldly point of view, gosh, I mean, there's not much to be said for death. You're just dead. You're just suffering. So I can fully understand, you know, from the worldly point of view, the appeal of, you know, dying early, appeal of you know, voluntary euthanasia, which I suppose it's actually a sort of spur to Christians. If we're going to talk to people about, if we're going to oppose euthanasia, we're going to oppose the death with dignity movement, we also have to go out of our way to try to tell people about the Lord and about, you know, exactly why, you know, what the world is really like and why death with dignity is they think it is a bad thing and why suffering is redemptive. And oddly enough, that means to make the argument about death with dignity isn't just a sort of practical or a public argument. It's an argument that depends upon our sharing our faith and trying to bring people to see, and essentially trying to bring people to the Lord and his church.
Yeah, because right, without that hope, then there is no reason to go through all that pain and suffering and spend the extra time. If you don't have that hope, you just say, well, then let's end it early. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it in that term before.
I mean, I think that's actually an important point. I've been involved in these public debates on this and, you know, other issues for 30 years, roughly, and writing about them. But, you know, Christians tend not to understand that they actually know something the world doesn't. And what they know about, you know, essentially about the whole cosmos, and mm-hmm. who, you know, about, and who runs the cosmos and what he wants, you know, really makes a huge, huge difference. So Christians often give kind of Christian-y arguments to the world, and the world just says, I have no idea what you're talking about. That makes no sense. You know, the world is like, if you don't know God, if you don't know the Christian story, if you don't know the gospel, if you don't know what Christ has done for us, then someone's talking about death with dignity, you know, being refined and reformed by suffering and growing in holiness, they're just going to look at us like we're nuts. You know, oddly enough, a lot of our Christian witness on these issues, those, you know, secular, what we might think of as secular or public issues, still come back to Christians being Christians and trying to bring people, you know, to meet the Lord.
Yeah.
To meet God, to enter the church. And it sounds like a cop-out, but it really isn't. The only way you're going to get someone to understand what's bad about the death with dignity movement is if they actually have hope.
You did mention earlier about how the fact that your dad didn't accept dying early and dying in, you know, what might seem to be an easier way, this death with dignity way, that in him sticking it out and playing the cards that he had been dealt, so to speak, that he was protecting other people, protecting more vulnerable people. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Like, yeah, as I said, you know, he lived as if, you know, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. You know, in either case, blessed be the name of the Lord. And that's the way, I mean, that's the way he lived. He'd been given blessings. He had a family, a job, et cetera. You know, and then he was given, the Lord took all those things away. And in, you know, in both cases for him, you know, blessed be the name of the Lord. And that was a great lesson. But when someone lives like that, practically speaking, and says, you know, my life is not mine to give up just because it's painful, just because I don't want to live it anymore because it's too hard, because I'm suffering, you know, he's got the choice to do that. I mean, even then, this was 5 years ago in Massachusetts, he could have found, I am sure, a doctor who would have collaborated quietly in some, you know, a form of euthanasia. I mean, he could have made, he had the choice to make, and he refused it. Even then, now, of course, with the spread of, you know, death with dignity movement and laws, it's even easier for people to make that same choice. But because he, who had the choice, did not make it, he says, you know, he proclaims to the world, you know, our lives are not ours to take, which means in terms of people who are vulnerable, you know, say, you know, people who are, you know, mentally disabled or, you know, have Alzheimer's or, you know, in some other way, you know, can't really make decisions for themselves. He says, if my life isn't mine to take, their lives isn't for you to take. I mean, if you're running a hospice, this person in the bed who's just occupying a bed costs you money, or it costs the government money, or costs someone money, and they're going to say, you know, he's old, he's got Alzheimer's, he can't really think, he doesn't recognize anybody anymore, his quality of life is just not so high, it's not very good, let's just put him out, essentially, let's put him out of his misery. I mean, there'll be a great temptation to do that, but when someone like my dad, or people, other people who have the same choice, says, no, no, I'm not dying because it's not my choice, you know, he does actually also say, and it's not your choice to take their lives either.
And we're seeing this too play in even on the other side, where we're seeing a growing rate, really sadly, of infanticides, legal infanticides happening over in Europe. Thankfully, not so much in America yet, but that's also, I mean, it's based on the same idea that this person is going to have what we think or what we want to classify as a low standard of life. And so we're just going to end their lives now on the premise that they're going to be suffering. And so your dad, yeah, really did a lot of good for the movement, as does anyone who is suffering and is terminally ill, but refuses to give in that they're making a stand, like you said, for everyone else in saying our lives aren't ours to end. We are here to live out our life as long as we can, to the fullest extent that we can. And that is then a witness to everyone else that that's also true for people who aren't able to speak for themselves yet, regardless of why they can't speak for themselves.
Yes, I think it's true. And I mean, the sad thing about it, the revealing thing about the movement is, say, Down syndrome children. I mean, what is it, 90% of Down syndrome pregnancies are the children that are known to have Down syndrome are aborted before birth?
Right. It's, yeah, about 94 right now. 94% of children who are diagnosed in the womb with Down syndrome are aborted.
You think about that and you think, okay, this isn't a hard case. I mean, you can imagine someone saying this is a severely retarded or disabled child. Okay, let's set that hard case aside. Down syndrome children are just not as smart as other children. That's it. I mean, and lots of people aren't as smart as other people, but we don't make that a criterion for anyone else's life. I mean, and you know, every parent of a Down syndrome child I know loves, he's a wonderful kid. It's sometimes their favorite kid. So you have what seems to be, you know, what isn't even a hard case becomes, because they're inconvenient or they're, you know, they're not normal, quote unquote, normal. They're not going to be the football team captain. They're not going to be the valedictorian of their class. And so 94% of these perfectly, you know, every possible thing, normal children are aborted. I mean, that strikes me as a real sign for how decadent and, you know, wicked. And so this kind of idea, this kind of movement can get very fast.
Yeah.
Again, it's not the really hard cases that you really feel for. It's a case that, you know, this child deserves life just as much as anyone else. He's not a hard case. He'll be a wonderful son or she'll be a wonderful daughter. And yet even those kids, because they're not, you know, they don't fit some sort of, you know, worldly abstract ideal, wind up being aborted. And I think that's one of the signs of how wicked this movement is and how fast it gets so bad. Mm-hmm. It always begins with the hard cases, you know, and when the ones that really tug at everyone's heartstrings that really seem like a, you know, deeply theological or philosophical problem to wrestle with. It always starts there, but it doesn't stop there. You know, it keeps going to perfectly fine people that just aren't quite what other people want.
Right. All of these things tie in, and sometimes we segment them out a little bit. But really, I mean, this fight for valuing life happens at both ends of that spectrum, and they are related. They're not separate from each other. But also in both of these cases, whether at the beginning of life, when we're talking about abortions and terminating pregnancies or early inductions for lethal fetal anomalies or any fetal anomalies, or if we're talking about at the end of life, trying to put a fast end to any kind of suffering or terminal illness that might be coming, we've talked a bit about the benefits of living out the rest of that life that the person who is dying experiences. But what are some of the benefits that you gained from being able to help your dad and being able to sit with your dad during those hours, during his suffering, and see him in that place? What are some of the benefits that you gained from that, or that your family members gained from that?
I would say among the things you learn, or I learned, and I've also lately been helping a close friend who's dying of cancer. So it's something I've been pondering lately. You know, among the things you learn is how much that you value, how much of, that you think is really important isn't nearly as important as you thought.
Mm.
You know, I write for a living. It's my calling. It's my vocation. It's what I think God has given me to do. And so I want to sort of, you know, jealously guard my hours of writing and reading and creativity and so on. So I can set myself up as creative people tend to do, as the artist. The artist can't be disturbed, who sort of rises above these sort of merely human requirements and ties and things. It's easy to sort of elevate yourself. And what you learn when you actually have to care for someone, when you actually, you're in the middle of what you think is the greatest sentence you've ever written and someone calls you for help, it teaches a lot about what you're actually put on the earth to do and what you're actually called to do. Because you realize that my self-image is the artist, is the creative one, is the one who can't be disturbed, who's calling, takes me above sort of merely human requirements. You know, it does actually teach you, no, you're a person who's called to serve. You're a person called to help others. You're a person who's called to help this particular person right now. So put the computer down or put the piece of paper down and pen down and get over there and get water or fetch the medicine or, go wash the clothes or whatever you have to do. So I think that's the biggest thing. It's forced me to be less of a sort of less selfish, I suppose, and less of an egotist or narcissist. I mean, this is a constant struggle for most of us to be less egotistical and selfish, but especially for people, creative people who have that great through the, the worldly excuse of I'm a creative person, I'm a writer, so leave me alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a wider vocation than maybe what you've labeled yourself as having.
I think I have a particular vocation that the world has elevated in a sense that encourages egotism and selfishness and narcissism, but everyone has the temptation to say, whatever I'm doing is more important than serving others. Or serving this particular person God has given me to serve. So it's a pretty universal temptation.
Yeah, my little sister and I actually have a funny little joke that we tell back and forth now about exactly what you were saying, that we get so wrapped up in what God has called us to do and saying, okay, I've been called, maybe for me it's event planning. I've been called to do event planning. And then he breaks you out of that using someone else's life and says, nope, your vocation is wider than that. Your vocation is to serve. And so my little sister, she used to, I think she might still pray while she was trying to fall asleep at night. And there was one night where I kept thinking of things that I wanted to tell her. And so I'd say, hey, Susan. And then, yada, yada, yada. And she'd say, okay, good night. And then I'd say, hi, Susan. And finally she goes, Abigail, would you shut up? I'm trying to pray. And I just feel like it was such a perfect representation of what we so often fall into on accident, that we put this certain thing that we've said, this is what God wants us to do. And we put that up on a pedestal. And in so doing, ignore what God has called us to do in a more broad sense. And I think that is that same tie into this death with dignity piece, that we think, well, no, I'm going to be a dignified person. I'm not going to be a burden. For some people, it's that. I'm not going to be a burden on my family. God hasn't called me to be a burden. He's called me to be a help. And now this is only going to make me a burden. So I'm not going to let that happen. When really he might be calling you to let your family serve you for a while, to let them learn how to love you more deeply. And so if you cut all of that short, you lose that opportunity to allow them to love you in so deep and so honest a way.
Yes, that's very good. Yeah, I think that was my family's experience. I spent most of the time with my dad. But I think just the fact that we drove up from Western Pennsylvania to the middle of Massachusetts, everyone had to disrupt their schedules. The kids had jobs. They had to, they lost money because they weren't working. We did all these things, and they went and got flowers. They hung out. They read to them. They talked to them. I never really thought about that, but it was a formative experience for them. Because here's their granddad. Our youngest I think was 9 or 10 at the time. Mm-hmm. And here's out of the four. So here's their granddad. He's always been the granddad. He's the guy who took care of them and took them to the zoo, and the guy who would reach them. Also, the guy who would sometimes be grumpy in the morning, and he's trying to get his coffee and read the newspaper, and the kids were up and sort of banging around. And Yeah, so they've got all these memories that, but he was a strong man. He was the granddad, and now suddenly they're doing all these things for them. And I think that was really important to them, to even the brief time we had to serve. My dad died very quickly once we found out he was dying, in a matter of weeks. Even that brief time, I think, actually was a formative thing, formative experience for them to actually serve someone, and it marked their lives and taught them something about service and kindness and unselfishness. They probably would not have learned otherwise, or learned so graphically or so concretely or so personally.
Well, thanks so much, David, for joining us and for letting us in on this really intimate experience that you've had and how it's formed your ideas about the Death with Dignity movement and how that's progressing and what that will do to the humanity that we each hold. If our listeners want to read some more of your work, read up on those articles that you edit and the magazines that you edit, where can they find those at?
The article you mentioned is on your website, but also firstthings.com. Also, ethicapolitica.org, and that's actually spelled E-T-H-I-K-A.
Okay.
P-O-L-I-T, Politica, both with K's instead of C's. And then thestream.org. So
okay.
Those are three places.
Great.
And also, actually, I write a column for the Catholic site Aletheia, which is A-L-E-T-I-C-E-I-A.com.
All right. Wonderful. So our listeners, you can check him out there as well. But thanks so much, David, for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you or someone you know is in a crisis pregnancy, help is just a phone call away. Call 877-791-5475. If you or someone you know is dealing with grief and pain after an abortion decision, call 877-791-5475. You'll be referred to a crisis pregnancy center in your area, a place where free and confidential services are available. That's 877-791-5475. 877-791-5475.
Allen County Right to Life invites community supporters to its second annual Harvest Celebration for Life on Monday, August 29th. The event is hosted at the Joseph Dequeue Wagyu Farm, 6 miles outside of Roanoke. This beautiful evening raises funds for Three Rivers Educational Trust Fund to continue the pro-life advocacy and education efforts in Northeast Indiana. The evening includes a short program with keynote address by Peter Heck, followed by drinks, heavy hors d'oeuvres, and a silent auction in the Hops Garden. Register at iChooseLife.org.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to iChooseLife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.